chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to be covering some of the Aspen Security Forum. Today, we're going to be talking a little about Bohemian Grove out there in the San Francisco area. And also, we're going to be touching base and bringing up to date on these tankers that have been taken over by Iran. I think one's been turned back. But we'll cover a lot of the current news up to date. So anyway, this first clip is about how to do business in China. And it first has to deal with trade policy and whether or not there's agreement that Trump is pursuing good trade policy or not. But here we go with some experts at the Aspen Security Forum.
Two questions to Ed Luce. I hope he'll work them in to questions to this all-star panel. Isn't Trump essentially right that China has not been playing by the rules? Doesn't China have to make structural changes, and isn't he right to push? And wasn't he wrong to leave the TPP, 40% of global GDP, because that reduced our leverage to push them? I would be very interested to hear the comments of Tom and Steve and Anya and Ed, you as well. Take it away.
Thank you, Nick. That was a great first panel, and we're going to build on that. They, I think, did a brilliant job of looking at the various trade deals that Trump is in the middle of, either succeeding or wrecking. But we're going to take it up a little bit higher, and we're at 9,000 feet here in Aspen, so we're justified in taking it to a slightly higher altitude. And I've got a brilliant panel here to talk about. I can hear you, and you've got a similar accent to me, but and you don't have a mic on, so it must be a very bad mic. Can you hear me now? You can hear me? Okay. We're going to build on the previous panel. We're going to take it up a little bit in terms of altitude. And we're going to look at whether U.S. business can succeed in China. And as we've discussed before, that it immediately entails the question, what is it that U.S. business wants the American government to do on its behalf in terms of trade relations with China? And so we've got a very, very qualified panel to discuss this hugely important and I think underappreciated subject, starting with Tom Pritzker, needs no introduction, very well known businessman, philanthropist, head of Hyatt Hotels, many business interests in China, money making, I believe. Yeah. Next to Tom is Anya Manuel, who is the co-founder and principal of Rice Hadley Gates, a company that advises American businesses on how to navigate international waters, particularly Chinese waters, author and former State Department official. And finally, Steve Orlins, who is head of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations, which has been around, correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, since 1966, since before ping-pong diplomacy, and which exists, has always existed, and still exists, to promote understanding and engagement between U.S. and China, something that is perhaps a little bit more rare nowadays than it was a few years ago. And so I would like to, Steve, since you've been in this role since 2005, you have seen a complete transformation, or at least a big transformation, in how U.S. business views China. It used to be pretty clear that most U.S. business lobbies, Chamber of Commerce, Business Roundtable, etc., with perhaps the exception of the National Association of Manufacturers, would basically argue China's case to some degree in Washington, argue it should be let into the WTO, that we should be patient, that globalization is going to pay off for all of us eventually. Now, is there a business consensus? It seems to be pretty much invisible if there is one. Talk to us a little bit, set the table a little bit, about what's changed since you became head of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations.
Happy to do that. There's no question that the consensus that used to support constructive U.S.-China relations has dissipated, and the business community was the ballast of that. And it's interesting because I kind of wrote down a few numbers, which makes this kind of very surprising, which is revenues, reported revenues, so publicly listed companies that have talked about their revenues in the greater China area, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and China, but it effectively, these are China, $52 billion from Apple. General Motors sold 43% of its total car production in China. Caterpillar, $12 billion. Starbucks, $4.5 billion, opening a Starbucks almost every day. Nike, $5.2 billion. Texas Instruments, $7 billion. Qualcomm, $15.1 billion. And Anya will point out that's going to disappear given the Huawei situation. So given that, why has this consensus disappeared? Why does the business community not stand up to the Trump policies, which are quite based on polling and discussions with businesses, is destructive to their business in China, destructive to their exports. U.S. exports to China are now dropping. They were down 13% in the second quarter. So it's clearly wrong, but they're not standing up. And I think there are a bunch of issues, and some relating to very specific actions that the Chinese government have taken. One is just promise fatigue. Chinese always are saying we're going to do this, and they never get around to doing it. They've promised market access. They've promised IPR protection. They've promised regulatory transparency. They've promised a level playing field, and it's not happening. So at some point, you get tired of it. And what happened is in around 2015, this began to deteriorate. In 2015, remember back, President Obama and President Xi had a terrific summit meeting at the White House, and they reached agreement on a number of issues, two of which I think, even though one is not business related, had an enormous effect on kind of the perception of China. One was actually the South China Sea, that China said we will not militarize the islands. That's not a big business issue, but everybody was aware of it. And what happens is the Chinese welched on that promise. They also said we're going to stop, the government is going to stop hacking into U.S. businesses. And for a time, after the summit, it did. Now everybody says it's continuing again, the theft of intellectual property is increased again. So that was kind of almost a seminal point in the business community's perception. The other was Qualcomm's acquisition of NXP. 2.5 years ago, Qualcomm entered into a, how many billions of dollars? A $15 billion acquisition of, or more than that, acquisition of NXP, which had antitrust implications. The EU approved, the US approved, the Japanese approved. The Koreans, despite that this was competitive with Samsung, approved. And the Chinese sat on it for 18 months. They sat on it. They didn't act. Clearly, this was something that should have been approved. But it affected the businesses of Chinese competitors. So they failed to act, and Qualcomm paid a $2 billion breakup fee. $2 billion, it ain't small potatoes, even to a company like Qualcomm. But what that did is it told the business community, you're not going to get regulatory fairness. So that perception shifted even more.
So when you say the business community, clearly there was a consensus. Are you saying there is a new consensus now in business?
It's a divided consensus. There are those who believe that Trump's policies are killing their business, that we're losing the fastest growing consumer market in the world, and they're counterproductive. And there are those who believe that it's terrific that he's shaken it up, and it's important that the Chinese go through this structural reform, which we heard talked about in the last panel, and that they do this. So it's okay to kind of have short-term pain for long-term gain.
So something approaching that. Anya, you wanted to intervene.
I just want to jump in and build on what Steve said, because I agree wholeheartedly. For me, the inflection point came with the Xi state visit to Obama in 2015. It actually happened even before Trump, as much as we always like to blame President Trump. And you said it exactly right. It was promise fatigue. So I live in Silicon Valley. I work with a lot of American tech companies. I would say before 2015, all the questions we were getting is, what are we doing wrong? Why are we, specific American company, not succeeding? And what can we do to help the Chinese understand that we're on their side? Then before Xi went to Washington, there was a dinner in Seattle that I think maybe all of us were at. And several of you hosted. And several of our clients said, how can I avoid being in the picture with Xi? And from then on, it's really been, well, it's time for them to buck up and do what they need to do and give us market access and protection.
So in answer to Nick's question, which I don't think I need to pose, you agree implicitly with his premise that Trump is right to call out China, that this consensus was shifting before Trump was even nominated.
I do agree with that. I think the way he's going about it is all wrong.
Okay, we're going to get into the all wrong.
I do not agree with his approach. I mean, I do not agree with his approach. But does China need to reform? Yes. I think the approaches that we're taking are the exact wrong approaches. And what we're in the last panel, we heard talk about enabling the reformers. There's still, Bill talked about it, there still are lots and lots of reformers in China. And what the policies that we've adopted are, is we are disenfranchising the reformers. We are making sure that the reform that they are seeking to advocate for will not be implemented.
There's a consensus among these panelists that Trump is right about trying to level the playing field with China, but his approach is wrong and not helping these reformers that are in China bring any reform back. Anyway, this next one is about regulation. The same panelist discussions at the Aspen Institute. These are clips of, and we're going to list the full interviews on our thesecrettruth.com. But we're going to just play these simple clips to get you a little taste of what's going on out there, but a good insight also. So here we go with additional business in China, but from a regulation viewpoint.
Elmar Davison with ZDF German TV. I liked your comment, Anya, about the need to go on the offensive with regards to rules and standards for technology and AI. We had an interesting discussion during the Munich Security Conference where Brad Smith of Microsoft was calling for those kinds of regulations, Digital Geneva Convention, old idea, all of a sudden on the table again. And there was this quote of the Chinese scientist saying, well, for the first time ever, this technology is give us the chance to win over liberal democracies. So that, I think, displays what is at stake here. And my question to you would be, to all of you, since the G20 adopted the OECD principles for AI, who should be the leader in pushing forward with setting those kinds of standards and rules? What body, who in the U.S. government should and could do that?
This is such a difficult issue because as the U.S. government, we are woefully underprepared to deal with modern technologies. We don't really have people embedded in each ministry that understands it. We regulate iteratively, so we say, okay, we're here, slap a regulation on it, but then technology devolves really rapidly, and we're not nimble enough to take that into account. And it's very different when you're talking about AI versus bio and CRISPR and everything that's coming down, and different technologies need different solutions. On AI, I could imagine one way to do it. Amy Webb, who's a computer scientist and scholar here, has called for something, she calls it a tech-NATO, I wouldn't call it that, but basically a group of 10 countries that would get together as national countries, not under auspices of the UN, and say, okay, we're democracies. Here's kind of what we think the broad guidelines are. Here's how you don't infringe privacy. Here's how you handle data appropriately. Here's what you do. China probably wouldn't be one of those 10 initially, but you wouldn't exclude them. You would say, look, here's the bar. Please rise to meet it. And that's what we've done with a lot of other international accords. They're never perfect. You know, they're always broken in some sense, but that's how you could start. And you could have something like that on every different technology. But we're nowhere near that. That's wishful thinking.
Tom or Steve, would you, either Tom or Steve, like to take that question?
No, we've gone next.
I just say that that how do you enforce compliance becomes an important part of it. That goes back to the scale issue. If we've got the scale that we talked about yesterday in NATO, if we've got the scale that Anya mentioned, you've got a better chance of enforcing any standards.
And so just quickly follow up on your answer, Anya. Previous panel talked about having global rules on antitrust. Presumably that would be one of the things you would like to see a U.S. administration develop.
Yeah, I know less about that, but antitrust in the tech sense to me doesn't make a whole lot of sense because it's the aggregation of data we're worried about, not necessarily market power. It just works in a totally different way, so we need to think about it.
You have to look towards the next administration, obviously, because this one is not willing to participate in those kinds of global fora.
That's right.
Gentleman here.
You mentioned several numbers that are interesting. In terms of STEM, we're like 21 or 31?
31.
31. And there, China is 10. And then you mentioned that we have 350,000 Chinese students in universities in the United States. And I was just recently aware that Li Wanxing, the wealthiest man in China, is building a new university for training entrepreneurs in technology. So knowing all these numbers, do you think that it's time for us to reconsider training engineers and technicians of Chinese for China?
A good number of them remain in the United States. So if we had a good visa policy, which basically when you get a PhD in a U.S. university, you automatically have the right to work in the United States, fewer of them would go back to China. Under current policies, the H-1B is being more restricted, so we have more Chinese returning to China. But these Chinese make enormous contributions to American universities, American academia, and then ultimately American business. So in no way, shape, or form would I support restricting these people coming to the United States.
China has taken some of the top talent, the Chinese talent that were here, and given them enormous sums of money to come back to China.
It's no question that they're willing to fund people to go back when they graduate from, you know, the best university system in the world. They're willing to fund them to go back and work. That's a cost we should be willing to pay for the contributions that the other 349,000 make to U.S. society. If you go to universities and you look at the TAs in the STEM fields, they're probably a third Chinese. We wouldn't be able to educate our own people if we lost the Chinese coming in. For reasons I don't fully understand, Americans just have been unwilling to matriculate through the STEM fields and get their PhDs.
Yes, the lady at the back there.
Thank you. Jennifer Glass from Al Jazeera. Change usually brings opportunity as well. Have the ructions over the last 3 or 4 years brought business opportunities in China? Okay. And is the business community concerned about China's Belt and Road initiatives as it gains ports in Sri Lanka, in Djibouti, and around the world, and a foothold in Europe? How are you approaching that as business?
Excellent question. Who would like to? Tom?
Do you want to take the opportunity?
Yeah, I'll take a stab at it. On Belt and Road, I think that much of the business community, frankly, doesn't understand it. What you described, I understand. Most CEOs, it's not in their area of direct interest. Some it is, the infrastructure guys. So yes, it'll bring new opportunities. As you build infrastructure, there's lots of opportunities. That's been very helpful. Are there new opportunities in China coming out of the last 3 or 4 years? Yes, of course. It's a dynamic country. It's bringing change to the world. And as you point out, that change brings opportunity. So undoubtedly, there are new opportunities coming out of this.
In the tech sector, I don't see a lot of new opportunities. Most people are retrenching. In finance, as Steve already said, a lot of new opportunities. And by the way, also with Belt and Road, increasingly you see our financial institutions saying, well, maybe we could fund this road and this railroad. That seems like a dangerous proposition to me, but they're thinking about it. On Belt and Road, I agree with Tom. I haven't heard, just the U.S. companies I deal with aren't so engaged in it. And I would say just in general, our analysis in the U.S. is always lagging behind a little bit. So we're a little slow to realize how big this issue is and that China is really doing this on a massive scale, and it could have consequences in how beholden third world countries are to China. But now everyone's talking about Belt and Road and how dangerous it is, and I think in its structure, it sows the seeds of its own destruction in a way. So when I now go to South Africa, which was early on Belt and Road, they say, oh my God, we sold the store to China. We don't want to do that anymore. You talk to countries in South Asia and Central Asia, and they all say, oh my God, look at Sri Lanka and that white elephant port. We don't want to be them. And you see countries being more thoughtful about how they engage with China.
One other thought, and that is, I never want to compete with someone who doesn't care about profit, who doesn't have a profit motive. And in much of China's Belt and Road, it's not a profit motive. And so I look at that and say, stay away from that world.
Yes.
Lockheed Martin Space. We're watching China enter into the very high-tech market of space and satellites in an aggressive fashion, particularly in the last 3 years, taking a market share that had never been addressed by China in critical infrastructure for telecommunications from space. And they're using Belt and Road investments to influence the acquisition decisions. Do you see a way where American and European competitors can play on a balanced playing field, or is the playing field now entirely tilted?
What our government should be doing is, rather than declaring that this is dangerous, that the BRI projects are dangerous, we should be arguing for open, transparent, and fair bidding for all these projects. That what the U.S. financial institutions who are trying to be involved in it are saying is, just make it open, fair, and transparent. And we're good with it. And U.S. construction companies, what I've been telling the Chinese government is, include a U.S. company in each of these transactions. It will do whatever the economic consequences are. It does wonderful things for the world's perception of BRI.
And Steve, I would just add to that, you brought up a really important hard point, which is that a lot of the Chinese companies are massively supported by the state. So Huawei underbids everybody by 30% or more, and it sounds like you're seeing the same thing in space.
We've got time, I think, for one more question. I did see the other hand. Oh, at the back, the lady. Yeah.
Thanks. Priscilla Moriucci with Recorded Future. So there's been a series of laws over the past few years, national security law, the cybersecurity law, for example, that have passed in China. There are these sort of broad, vague, kind of sweeping laws, right, that have attempted to define the role of the government and the military and the security services in, you know, tech and the business community. So on the ground, like, what are the actual concerns for foreign businesses in China, you know, about these sort of newly stated obligations, right, to work with the intelligence and security services, you know, from the business community's perspective? Like, we hear a lot of discussion about possible concerns and what this could mean, right, for foreign businesses. But at this point in sort of the development of these laws and regulations, what is the impact on foreign business, right, and how is that,
yeah,
is that looking?
Maybe I'll take this one.
Yeah.
You're right to raise the concern, and I think saying they're worried about it is an understatement. These laws are so broad that the Chinese government can interpret it any way they want. One of them is all technology sold into China has to be secure and controllable. What does that mean? Does that mean the Chinese government has access to all of your code, to some of your code? Can you prove that it's secure and controllable outside? Is there 100% censorship? The answer is yes. More and more you see these laws being used differently. I'm thinking of one example in particular where a U.S. tech company has a JV in China, and every board meeting there are new requirements. It used to be, well, you can only own 49% in order to sell into any Chinese SOEs. Now you can only own 25%, so you got to sell more of your stake. So this is a really powerful lever by which the Chinese are controlling Western technology companies.
And what it's doing is it's inhibiting investment. So companies, technology companies that might otherwise invest, decide not to do it because the risk is too high. Therefore, the Chinese don't get the benefit of this technology. Therefore, their economic growth slows. These counterproductive regulations, unfortunately, China is replete with them. I mean, I have forever argued the ban on Facebook, Google, YouTube, Twitter, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg is bad for China. It's bad for those organizations too, but it's bad for China. It inhibits people's ability to do research, to communicate, and do all these other things. Now, the president obviously decides he wants that level of control. But in the end, you know, the number of people who have VPNs who go around this is so significant that the control is already eroding. And hopefully there were signs a couple of years ago that we might see some Chinese revision of these restrictions. Now in the tightening and because of the tension in U.S.-China relations, this has disappeared. So what one of the things that by kind of demonizing China, by saying it's all bad, that not having this nuanced view, we persuade the Chinese to make no concessions whatsoever because it's going to be viewed as too favorable to the United States.
Now, I think that Trump is on the right, trade policy and business policy with China. China's a tough customer to try to deal with anyway. And you're not going to get anywhere with the Chinese from some weakened, well, we're going to rely on some reformers to bring about reform. That's not going to do it. It's going to be hard dollars and cents and trade and money that will bring the Chinese to the table eventually. But you have to, always with the Orientals, you've got to provide them some space-saving mechanism where they can come to the table and make a deal with you. And maybe he just hasn't done that yet. So there's an important aspect to this. Peter Thiel, just recently, founder of PayPal and eventually reinvesting that into Facebook, had been very critical about Google's move to China and using their AI to benefit possibly the military of China. And this could be on the edge of treasonous activity, according to Peter Thiel. He was recently, this week, interviewed by Tucker Carlson, and here's what he had to say about China and especially Google's work with the Chinese. Here we go now.
Peter Thiel co-founded PayPal. He was one of the very first investors in Facebook. If anyone knows a lot about big tech and its power and its potential dangers, it's Peter Thiel. So it means something when he warns that Google, the world's most powerful company, has become a threat to American national security. They may even have committed treason, he says. While speaking at the National Conservatism Conference in Washington yesterday, Thiel warned that Google may have been infiltrated by Chinese intelligence and ought to be subject to immediate investigation by the FBI and the CIA. We're happy to have Peter Thiel join us tonight. Peter, thanks a lot for coming on.
So, thanks for having me.
What did you mean when you said that?
Well, it was just in the form of a set of questions I asked where, you know, artificial intelligence is something people talk about nonstop in Silicon Valley, but they almost never talk about its dual use. If it's real, if this is a real thing, it obviously can also be used by the military. It'll be weaponized in all sorts of ways, and it's an important national security question as to who has it. There's this very peculiar background where Google is working with the Chinese communist government and not with the U.S. military. So the Project Maven decision was a decision not to work with AI with the U.S. military, but they're working with the communist Chinese. And so the question is, you know, from the outside is just what in the world is going on there? And I sort of suggested a few different possibilities, but I think, it's been they described it as a Manhattan Project for AI. And so if you go around broadcasting that you're building the Manhattan Project for AI, I would think this naturally would draw the attention of foreign intelligence agencies. I think the Chinese are competent enough that the Ministry of State Security is likely to have infiltrated Google And then I think the Google management has sort of a decision of either letting the software go out the front door or figuring it'll get stolen anyway and go out the back door.
When you say you believe that Chinese state security is likely to have infiltrated Google, what would that what is
well,
that
if you call, if you say you're building a Manhattan Project for AI, don't you think that would attract the interest of foreign intelligence agencies?
Yes.
It's just hidden in plain sight. And then they are well, I think there are sort of all these ways that that Chinese nationals are engaged in espionage in the U.S. It's it's understandable that China is doing that. They see themselves in a very serious competition with the U.S. But we're not particularly on our guard about it. And if you have sort of a series of super futuristic tech projects that you broadcast to the whole world, it's at least a suspicion. And then the weird fact that's indisputable is that Google is working with Communist China, but not with the U.S. military, on its breakthrough AI technology.
Why is that?
Well, that's the question. I mean, I think one explanation is they figure they have to, because if they don't give it to them through the front door, it'll get stolen through the back door. So first answer is they have to. And then I think, of course, there's probably a broad base of Google employees that are ideologically super left wing, sort of woke, and think that China's better than the U.S. or that the U.S. is worse than China. It's always more anti-American than
always.
Anything.
But this is, by definition, a threat to American national security, as you point out. So if Sundar Pichai was sitting right here, what would you say to him?
Well, I would say answer my three questions. How many foreign intelligence agencies have infiltrated Google? Have the Chinese in particular infiltrated? And why are you working with Communist China, not the U.S.? What is the reason you're doing
why
that?
Why do you think the questions you raise, and this is not in any way to minimize their importance, are kind of obvious questions? Why hasn't the U.S. government ascertained the answers?
Well, it's possible that there are people in the U.S. government looking into it and they haven't told us. But I think the FBI and CIA would be the natural places to look into it. The FBI would look at it from the domestic side. The CIA would look at it from the outside in, and would try to look at seeing if from the outside there are people controlling people inside Google or
so. As someone
like that.
Who's this is almost rhetorical, but as someone who's built a lot of companies as you have. Do you think it would have been possible to create, to incubate, and grow a company like Google in China?
I think the U.S. is still better at innovation and at starting things, but it certainly can be copied and replicated.
Right.
And something like this is true of all the breakthrough technologies we have. Most of them are still originating and developing in the West, but they don't give us much of an advantage if they get transferred, in a matter of a few years, if not a matter of months.
So I have to ask you, I assume you're watching the Democratic primaries unfold. Who's the most impressive candidate in that race, do you think?
Well, I'm most scared by Elizabeth Warren. I think she's the one who's actually talking about the economy, which is the only thing that I think matters by far the most.
Yes.
And then I think almost all the others are equally unimpressive in the sense that it's all identity politics of one flavor or another. And I wouldn't want to rank how unimpressive they are, since you'd be forcing me to rank the different identities and which one's more privileged and more special. that would be a dangerous thing to get into.
It's hard to know.
But I think Elizabeth Warren's the dangerous one.
That's right. Peter Thiel, it's great to see you. Thank you.
Thanks.
There are some dynamic things occurring. Let me tell you a little bit about Peter Thiel, or Peter Thiel of Deutsch. He founded PayPal, like Tucker Carlson said. Then he sold PayPal, his interest, and reinvested that, a good portion of it, into Facebook. So he became a major stockholder in Facebook. And after that, that thing took off and has made him hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't know how much. But what he's saying here, and I believe he's still the director of Facebook, is he's saying something that's really in the attack mode on Google. Now, Google originally, okay, was founded with, CIA money. But also, Palantir, which Peter Thiel established, was funded by CIA money. So, and then also, Peter Thiel is a steering committee member of the Bilderberg Group, which is one of the most powerful groups that meets yearly in the world. So with him attacking Google and then Eric Schmidt having resigned off of the resigned as chairman a few years ago, It's getting interesting to what is happening about Google. Then is Google under attack? And then is Peter Thiel throwing in with Trump and other people that consider Google to be a threat because of monopolistic practices? Something like that is going on, but it's a big, big change. And so we have to keep that in mind. Now, I've got a clip coming up with Austin Catherine Fitz, with the darkest journalist, okay? The dark journalist, I believe. And it's revealing this accounting change that occurred in 1995, that opened up some of these federal agencies to declaring certain projects as dark projects or black projects, secret projects, and then not having to divulge the accounting on those particular projects. So here we go with Austin Catherine Fitz. It's just very fascinating what she has to say.
And we are live. This is Dark Journalist. It's fantastic to be here with everyone. It's already a huge crowd tonight, and we have a very special guest with us tonight, with us, Catherine Austin Fitz, a very familiar guest on this show, but we haven't had her here in a little while. And first of all, it's good to see you, Catherine.
It's good to see you. It's good to actually, it's good to be back in Hickory Valley. I've been on the, you know, I could write a movie about my last 2 weeks traveling around America.
And before that, the world.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
This is an incredible travel schedule. And the new report is out. I want to stress this right away. This is a remarkable, not your average Solari report. It's so in-depth. And you took this theme of the real game of missing money. And you went through it in this way. But when you get in here, what I've noticed is it's such a hardcore version of the Solari report. It is so rich in detail, as they all are. But this one in particular, you've got the Federal Reserve, the black budget, FASB 56, where we're going to get into. This is very, very in-depth, even for the Solari report.
So because of the extraordinary compromise of the digital systems and the lack of integrity, I really felt it was essential to get the core material on the missing money into hard copy in one place and ship it out to the English-speaking world, which,
right.
You know, we've shipped it out to three continents. You know, I'm not sure the Hickory Valley Post Office will ever be the same.
You've upgraded them dramatically.
Right. So, well, we're certainly trying to keep them, you know, in the black. But so I wanted to get everything there, and it was over, you know, the typical wrap up is usually 100, 150 pages. So this went over 400 pages. And so we split it into two volumes being the essential documents for a serious due diligence, particularly by an institutional investor. And if you look at the kind of due diligence packages you get when you're an investment banker or you're an attorney, you know, they tend to be, they have a prospectus look. And so we decided to do black and white.
Yes.
Because it's with less graphics so that it's a very prospectus look and it communicates a serious due diligence effort. And I'm very pleased with it because, I've had so many people say, you know, I thought I understood this issue, but when I look at everything that you have produced together in one hard copy, I realize, wow.
Yeah.
You know, this is bigger and more serious and more real than I ever dreamed.
Right. Right. Absolutely. It's fascinating to me because I started right off the bat with a quote that you had in here, which was, the story, this is your quote. The story is simple and obvious. And you're reflecting here on FASB 56, the new accounting standards for the federal government. And we're going to get into this, but the quote is really fascinating. The story is simple and obvious. What is it about secret financing for secret armies that you do not understand? The U.S. government just officially changed its governance model from a constitutional republic to fascism through an obscure accounting policy, no need to bother with a constitutional convention. Catherine, what's going on with FASB 56? And let's just pretend here it's the first time anyone's ever heard of it.
So Dr. Mark Skidmore published his report in September 2017, that explained that the U.S. government had undocumentable adjustments in its DOD and HUD accounts from 1998 to 2015 of $21 trillion, which at the time was the same amount of the outstanding debt of the U.S. government,
right.
And had refused, as required by law, the federal government has refused to obey the law. So every year you give them a tax return that says, here's how my money worked, and they're supposed to give you a financial disclosure that says, okay, here's how we spent your money. But they have refused and essentially just broken the law every year since the mid-90s. And so when the report came out, there was a lot of hullabaloo. One thing led to another, and DOD said something they've said many times before, oh, we're going to do an audit. Now, my answer is, look, if there's $21 trillion missing, I'd much rather get the $21 trillion back than, you know, make sure you do an audit next year. It's good you want to do it next year, but I dare say if your bank wrote you a letter and said, we've lost or misplaced $21,000 of your money, but we promise it won't happen again, what would you say?
Yeah, I'd say that's great, but I want the check.
Right, exactly. So DOD started along a process of kind of pushing back against the Skidmore report in ways that made no sense, including trying to take down the documents, but we'd already put them up on our server. And then, you know, so they did a bit of a scramble and brought them up again and said, oh, well, we were just reorganizing our website. Or, you know, they did a lot of pushback at different radio shows that Dr. Skidmore would do where they made mistakes. They got things right. I mean, it was embarrassing. Anyway, so they proceed along the audit, and then right as they're starting the audit, they promulgate a draft FASB 56 policy. What this is, there's a group called the Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board that came out, in fact, of the legislative work that I and other people had done in the early Bush administration. It's a board of private accountants who are supposed to advise on different policies, and it's the corollary of a board in that does things on accounting in the private sector. So this was supposed to be the complementary public sector one. Anyway, so they come out with a draft proposal that basically says by a secret process, a secret group of people can take portions of the book dark without informing anyone.
Right.
Now, what that means is when you get the financial statements, they're totally meaningless.
Right,
because, in fact, I think it's a total of, it's all the agencies plus another 150 entities can just take something dark and you can't even know that they did it. So you have no idea what you're looking at. It makes the total federal government meaningless. Anyway, so they came out with this policy. They got comments. HUD commented, the different government agencies commented. HUD said, oh boy, this is great. We need this. Which raises the question, why does a domestic housing agency need to have a secret budget?
Yes.
Which, you know, we could address. And then the SEC didn't happen to mention that this is going to take most of the U.S. securities market dark when you combine it with other waivers and classification laws. They didn't seem to have a problem with it. Anyway, it was adopted, believe it or not, on the week that everybody was watching Brett Kavanaugh. Now, to adopt this policy, you need the General Accounting Office, now called the General Accountability Office, and you need the Office of Management and Budget.
Right.
Okay? So we're talking about bipartisan leadership in the Senate and the House, both Republican and Democrat, and the White House. Now, the Kavanaugh hearings would have persuaded you that they were having a serious war.
Right.
In fact, they weren't. They were agreeing to the greatest single increase in the swamp's power since the 47 and 49 Act.
Amazing.
Because basically what this said is the deep state can spend as much as they want, whenever they want, on whatever they want, and you can't even know that they're doing it or that they're making it secret that they're doing it. Okay?
Incredible.
So what this means is you can take all the money that you're using, you know, that you're getting from raising you know, money by selling treasuries, and you can spend it on whatever you want. You want weather warfare in the heartland? No problem. You've got the money. You want to burn down half of California? No problem. You've got the money. You want to pay the Saudis or the Israelis to blow up oil tankers? No problem. You've got the money. In fact, you've got enough money so that all the mercenary armies you've created and financed over the last 30 years can just bring in proposals and say, boy, do we have a deal for you? It'll make the U.S. stock market go up. And you can just say, that's great. You can write a check. In the same week this past, Blackwater in a mercenary magazine came out with a new ad saying, Blackwater is coming. Meaning they're changing the name back, right?
Wow.
It's morning in America for the mercenary armies. So what I said in the quote that you described, I was writing to a reporter, Matt Taibbi wrote a very good article on FASB 56. And one of the things I said is General Kelly and General Mattis used incredible personal gravitas to persuade Congress to give huge increases in the military appropriations. They were very opposed to the use of mercenary armies. After we locked in the appropriation increases, what happens? FASB 56 passes, right?
Yes.
They're out within a week.
Yeah, they got
through. Know, 1 to 4 weeks. And who is Kelly replaced by? He's replaced by the guy from OMB who engineered FASB 56 through. And what happens next? Of course, we get the Bushies back in, deal with the Bushies, and now Attorney General is a Bushy guy. You know, the Bushy guy that worked for George H.W. Bush.
Right.
So now we have the Bushies running basically the Department of Justice and probably the CIA. And we've got an infinite amount of money to do whatever we want, including, let me get this clear. Here's a pension fund with your money in it. Okay. Here's the Treasury. The Treasury issues securities, Treasury securities. Your pension funds buy them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now the Treasury has your money and you have an IOU from the Treasury, which is essentially an IOU from yourself.
Right.
Okay. You're on the line, your property, your taxes, you're on the line. Okay. Now Treasury has the money. Treasury just decides to spend it on a spaceship that they're going to make sure a defense contractor owns so it stays secret. They just shift the money out and now the big defense contractor who's publicly traded owns the asset.
Mm.
What did they get in return? Nothing.
Right.
So they've just laundered the money out of your pension fund and into a private deep state insider. And what have you got? You've got an IOU. So you've changed an asset and converted it into a liability. Instead of having a $100 asset, you now have a liability where you owe $100.
Hmm.
Okay.
Well, amazing.
Now, why do I bring this up? Because if there are no reliable financial statements, they can launder 100% of the money that's coming in on treasuries or taxes and just bail it. You know, that's what the bailouts were. We're talking about an open bailout structure on a permanent basis. The bailouts are not open. You know, they're not over. You know, now we're talking about perpetual bailout in perpetuity.
Incredible.
Now, this is a coup d'etat by accounting policy.
Next is how to defeat extremism, how to win. You know, we're going to have that. That's coming from the Aspen too. Here we go right now. Short little clip.
Good morning. I'm Susan Glasser from The New Yorker, and this is the lightning round version of the Aspen Security Forum. I'm delighted, in fact, to be here for a special conversation about her new book and many other things besides with Farah Pandeeth, who has the advantage of having served as a political appointee for both President Bush and President Obama at the State Department. And we're going to talk a little bit this morning about her new book, which I highly recommend to you, How We Win, How Cutting-Edge Entrepreneurs, Political Visionaries, Enlightened Business Leaders, not the unenlightened kind, and Social Media Mavens Can Defeat the Extremist Threat. Farah, thank you so much for joining us this morning. So I have to say, we had a little preview of this in our dinner table conversation last night, and I think we have to start out not with the book, but really with the sea change that has sort of occurred since you started writing this book, which was meant to be an account and is a fascinating account of your experiences in trying to think about how the United States could act globally to challenge the rising threat of extremism. there's sort of an elephant in the room, right, isn't there, in terms of what's happened since then. You were telling me about what it's like to be a woman of color traveling around the United States in 2019 talking about this book.
Well, first of all, you know, I can't imagine, I couldn't have imagined as I began this book that I would even have to be talking about the far right and the rise of white nationalists. It didn't even enter my mind. What I was thinking about are the next armies of ISIS, the next armies of Al-Qaeda. This book tour has been really enlightening for me. I grew up outside of Boston. I'm obviously an American. I'm obviously somebody who understands our country. But in the last few jobs that I've had, my job has been to serve our nation overseas. So I wasn't ready to be in rooms where people were saying things to me like, "You speak English really well." I said, "Thank you." You know, or "How did they let you serve in the White House and at the Department of State when you're not an American?" And, you know, it's stunning. It's stunning for so many reasons, for all of us. This isn't about being Muslim or being somebody who doesn't have white skin or doesn't have the purest blood, whatever that might mean. This is about what's happened to our country and what's happened to the world. So, yes, there has been a rise of extremism, and we have to talk about it. But while we pay attention, and we must pay attention to the rise of the far right and the white nationalists and the neo-Nazis and the sovereign citizens, ISIS is still recruiting. And that's the message here. You know, we have been lazy on all of this. America has been asleep at the wheel, looking at this issue like it's something that we have defeated and it's gone. Meanwhile, ISIS is still recruiting at pace. They are entrepreneurial and we are not. They are focused on a demographic that is 1 billion Muslims strong. And that frightens me.
Well, so, you know, there's so much to unpack here, right? Because we're really talking about the not parallel but intersecting national security conversations. It's not that the old post 9/11 conversation about rising extremism around the world or the threat from global jihadism. It's not that that conversation is ended. It's that it has been intersected with a whole new conversation here inside the United States, one which we're not really equipped to have in terms of national security. So let's talk about your original intent in trying to share your own experiences of what it was like to be at the State Department and trying and not always succeeding in addressing this. What is the effect right now of the United States looking inward and not paying attention to ISIS?
The lack of American leadership on this threat is very dangerous, and it's going to make a difference for us in the long term. It's going to cost us more in the long term, because the bottom line for how people recruit is that these young people are dealing with a crisis of identity. And that crisis of identity appears in a lot of different ways, and some of you will feel that even in the way our nation feels right now. We're asking ourselves questions about who we are as Americans, aren't we? And what it feels like and what we really stand for. Those young Muslims are asking those very same questions in a post 9/11 world, but the numbers are huge. And it isn't, America has looked at this issue, from a regional perspective. You know, what's happening in the Middle East? What's happening in Pakistan? What might be happening in Northern Africa? I'm here to say to you, in what I saw traveling to nearly 100 countries around the world, it was shocking for me to see that a Muslim living in a Muslim-majority country, as well as a Muslim living as a minority in that demographic of millennials, we're all having a crisis of identity. That has to be part of our strategy. So when America isn't looking at the real threat, that we aren't understanding the system that is underlying extremism, and only sort of playing whack-a-mole, we have the problem that we have today, which is the bad guys are continuing to recruit. We are continuing to see an interest in the us versus them ideology. And the scary thing, too, Susan, is that we have lost our imagination of what could come. So when we were thinking about AQ, we could not possibly have thought there would be an ISIS. Today, you might say, well, Farah, you might be looking at ISIS 2.0. I'm looking at the next dimension of who they're going to recruit, not just millennials, but Generation Z. And by the way, obviously not just men, but the all-women armies that are to come. So for me, how America leads, how it thinks about things, is critical to all of this.
Now, these speakers at these forums and these symposiums and whatever you want to call them, We have a system of teaching and conditioning and programming that's probably one of the best in the world in our colleges, especially in the colleges and universities. In our lower level, high schools and middle schools, it's defaulted into, we can't even teach students how to read anymore, or they don't want to, and they can't even count. They can't give you change in these fast food places, that's for sure. But what has evolved over several decades, 30 or 40 years, three or four decades or longer, has been a systematic system of conditioning and teaching and programming and propagandizing and so forth of our population, and even people that are specializing in foreign relations and economics and so forth are being taught certain preconceived curriculum, driven, you could say, information that makes them very, very easily cultivated into a system of control and dominance by the upper level people. Now, people go to the university all the time, and they come out with these highfalutin degrees, and they think they know something. But the world system is much more difficult to discern and to appreciate and to woke to. You know, just like this word woke, you know, like there's only a certain people that are woke, and then there's these people writing articles. I read one this weekend, and it said something about that what, you know, President Trump was doing lately about, send her back and all this stuff was on the verge of 1984, and it wasn't like Brave New World, but it was 1984 authoritarianism and all this other stuff. And these people are actually putting forth a lot of very high, skilled. I won't say skilled anymore, because it's obviously propaganda, because this is coming from the liberal left, democratic left, who went in, started spying and creating FISA with false information and spying on President Trump while he was campaigning, and even after he was in the transition period and into the presidency. So these are the people out here that are talking about him being a bigot or a racist, or, and then they're using this term now, send her back, because of Omar, say, as some, kind of Nazi. They're calling him a Nazi. She said the other day that he's a fascist, see. And then at this Aspen Institute, I didn't have enough time to play some of the comments, but it was all derogatory about President Trump, see. And even Albright, Madeleine Albright, wouldn't call him a Nazi, or a fascist, I should say, but she said he is the most undemocratic president of all time. And Obama was in there with scandal, rife with scandal. And then with Secretary of State Hillary, and they're willing and dealing with the Russians, and then they're trying to put that on Trump, see. I mean, these people are unconscionable, and they're on the side of, they're psychopaths, really, what we're talking about here. They have no conscience. They just will and deal and play the game, and for the big money, for the big power stakes, see. But they don't care about the country. Deep down, President Trump does care about the country, and he's a little bit controlled by the Israeli lobby and other people like that. But overall, he is bringing America back, and they don't want that. They're against the nation state, and they're trying to put us down. But thank you for listening, and good night, and God bless each and every one of you.